So
thanks. It's a pleasure to be here again. I can't remember if Johanna mentioned that last time that I was here, I think more or less exactly a year ago, I actually spoke about Kant and the revolution. So when I was invited again to speak about Kant and the revolution, there were actual negotiation about that. So I suggested calling the paper Kant on Enlightenment as Revolution 2 or something like that. And Johanna, because I'm not giving the same paper. Johanna said, don't be so vain. People do not remember. Now she's completely contradicting herself and says that because people are so smitten with talk. Anyway, so this is a paper that definitely builds on the previous paper that I gave here a year ago, just because it's it is a work in progress, something that I'm continuously reworking and adding chapters to. So this is a reworking of some old themes from the previous paper and adding to it. If someone was here last year, which I don't think so, very few people, then you will see. It is a part of a larger project, actually, as Johanna didn't mention because I don't think she knows about so much. I'm now working also on a side project in which I'm trying to suggest alternative ways to thinking the concept of enlightenment. We have historical ways of dealing with the philosophy of the Enlightenment movement, which is obviously a valid way to tackle the Enlightenment. But I want to address Enlightenment also as a philosophical concept. And we can do this with, I think, ancient philosophers, we can do this with medieval religious philosophers, and we can also do this with Kant. Kant, don't forget, was not answering the question, was ist die Aufklärung, what is the Enlightenment, but rather, what is Enlightenment? So not what is a philosophical epoch or what is the philosophy of the movement, but what is Enlightenment? And I think that often the answers that we can get from that are different from the ones that we commonly get. In a way, this will be my contribution to that perspective. And this is why the talk is titled Kant on Enlightenment as Revolution. Because we all know what is Kant's answer to the question, what is Enlightenment? Namely, think for yourself. But I try to show that if we go deeply into what that thinking for yourself means, then it quickly becomes revolution in all sorts of ways. And this introduces issues for Kant scholarship and for our understanding of Kant's political philosophy. And with this, I can go straight into the paper. So Kant's 1784 answer to the question, what is enlightenment, is well known. Enlightenment, he writes, is, and this is a quote, man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Immaturity, he adds, is, and I'm still quoting, the inability to use one's own understanding without the guidance of another. This definition has become so pervasive that it is by now difficult to doubt or question it, difficult even to feel the need to scrutinize its meaning. But at least one question about it should be mentioned at the outset. Namely, what counts as using one's own understanding? What counts as thinking for oneself? The straightforward answer Kant gives in the text, thinking for oneself is refusing another's authority over our beliefs and attitudes, is plausible, but providing a merely negative criterion, hardly sufficient. It only tells us what thinking for oneself is not. Moreover, the more you think of it, the less clear it becomes what a sufficient criterion should look like, or indeed whether the existence of such one wouldn't run counter to thinking for oneself. In this view, at least, it may not be a drawback of Kant's essay that it actually leaves us hanging vis-à-vis the question posed by the Berlinische Monatschrift. Perplexity is then increased by two exclamation marks which Kant builds into the text, which emphasize that the negative definition of maturity or for Enlightenment he provides contains no description, but a command. Sapere aude, dare to know. Have the courage to use your own understanding. Anyone who is not a child of the Enlightenment, in the worst sense of the term, would have to worry. Does following this command count for thinking for oneself? Is it not the case that insofar as we follow or obey this command, we don't? Then insofar as we don't, we do? Worse, not following the spirit of enlightenment begins to emerge as a necessary condition for following it. Since this movement often prides itself for its rationalism, this may be a sign of a problem. How are we to understand then the relation between thinking and following? Now, you may think that I'm artificially generating a paradox here from Kant's text, but then note that while Kant endorses in the Enlightenment essay the famous "think for yourself" slogan, later on in the text, he actually provides a more specific formulation, which some people have noticed and complained about. I'm quoting, "Think for yourself," he writes, and this is a quote, "argue as much as you please, but obey." He even says, "obey Frederick." What are we to make of this? Not just thinking and following them, but properly thinking and obedience. This insistence on obedience is offending, I think, to modern sensibilities, but notice, similar position has been endorsed not only by Kant, who people in any case like to scorn as a moderate, conservative, and timid philosopher, an obedient philosopher, but also by other philosophers, and indeed some of the ones who are nowadays celebrated as radical revolutionaries. Spinoza clearly endorses the spirit of think as much as you please but obey. I actually have a hunch that Kant picked up his own formulation from chapter 20 of the Theological Political Treatise. And of course, just as explicit here and interesting is Socrates, who loved thinking more than he loved his country, and who taught his young followers to love thinking more than they loved their country or society, but who still insisted on obedience. On whatever interpretation of the credo you would choose, the ultimate, and there may be different ones, there are different ones, the ultimate Socratic message to the youth corresponds directly to Kant's definition of maturity in what is enlightenment. Not just think for yourself. Think for yourself, but obey. So again, what are we to make of this thinking and obedience? I will argue that Kant's very late doctrine of genius and Geist in the Critique of Judgment, which he develops late in his career, in parallel with the French Revolution, in fact, is a way to solve these paradoxes of obedience and maturity. This doctrine elaborates a sophisticated notion of following the guidance of another, another whom we cannot understand, hence a notion of obedience, that doesn't amount to non-thinking. In fact, just the contrary. We'll see that according to this doctrine, we can only think for ourselves by following another. So you can only think for yourself by giving up autonomy. I will explicitly argue for this. If I'm correct, this doctrine of Kant's presents us with his mature account of what enlightenment is. This mature account redefines, among other things, the relation between enlightenment and religion, and on this I cannot comment here because we don't have time. I actually spoke about this a little bit more last year. But it also explains, I think, the mysteries surrounding Kant's perplexing position on the revolution, and on this I will comment. So let's begin with the concept of immaturity in Kant's enlightenment. On the first pass, immaturity is a tendency to comfortably forfeit thought by outsourcing it to others, the guardians. Quote, "If I have a book which understands for me, a pastor who has a conscience for me, a physician who decides on my diet, I need not trouble myself. I need not think if I can only pay." End quote. The structure of such immaturity is simple. Instead of thinking, I let the guardians do it. However, it is often and perhaps always overlooked that Kant recognizes another structure of immaturity, and one that's arguably deeper and more pernicious to enlightenment than simply outsourcing our thought. It isn't, strictly speaking, not thinking, but rather a way of thinking, a way of using one's reason in a dead or a mechanical way, which doesn't amount to thinking for oneself. Call this immaturity star now people will scold me as an analytic philosopher. Call this immaturity star to distinguish it from the common understanding of immaturity that we usually know from Kant's essay. It is, and this is a quote from the text, it is the use of statutes and formulas, those mechanical tools for the rational employment, or rather misemployment, of men's natural gifts that are the shackles of an everlasting immaturity, end quote. That is, the danger that I would make it my habit exactly when I do think, exactly when I do employ my reason, to fall back on dead, Kant says, mechanical, rational algorithm, is more obstructive to enlightened maturity than simply outsourcing to the guardians. By the way, it may be a mode of outsourcing, it may be a way of outsourcing, but a deeper way. Statutes and formulas. What are they then? Kant never says. Spinoza's use of the geometrical method, relying as it does on definitions, axioms, and demonstrations, which in the first critique, the critique of pure reason, Kant criticizes as inappropriate to philosophy, comes to mind here. And one may also think of what some people nowadays call the CI. The CI. Does anybody know what that is? Yes? The categorical imperative. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become universal law without contradiction. It is this immaturity of mechanical algorithms and formulas, immaturity star, that Kant identifies as a main impediment to enlightenment. Individuals, by and large, cannot achieve enlightenment on their own because of this form of immaturity, he says. Most of us have made it their second nature to fall back exactly when we do think on mechanical tools for the employment of reason. Okay. Despite this self-defying state of affairs, Kant also argues that achieving enlightenment in the public realm is, and this is a quote, almost inevitable. He gives almost no argument for his optimism about it. He only suggests, in the very same passage in which he speaks about immaturity star, that enlightenment will be first achieved, and this is a quote, by those few who succeed by their own exercise of spirit, geist, to rid themselves of the yoke of immaturity. End quote. If and only if this unique few would then, quote, disseminate the spirit, geist, of appreciating every man's vocation for thinking for himself, would the public achieve enlightenment as well? Speaking about thinking and obedience, then, right? For most of us, using our own understanding without the guidance of another actually depends on the guidance of some unique others. So hopefully the notion of genius and geist will help us understand Kant's position, and it will allow us to treat his position not as a contradiction, but as an antinomy. So Kant defines genius in the Critique of Judgment as, quote, the innate mental disposition through which nature gives the rule to art. If there is such a thing as fine, beautiful art, it cannot be produced through available concepts that are known or grasped by the artist or her audience, her publico. For producing aesthetic pleasure, art must be a presentation of purposiveness without purpose. A work of art proceeding through available conscious concepts would not achieve that, making its purpose manifest. Among other things, this implies that the gift of genius is different from an intellectual endowment, for the intellect's operation is essentially bound to cognition through universally available concepts. And the point here is that a work of genius cannot be grasped by universal concept, and hence not even by the artist herself. It follows from Kant's position here that the essential property of a genius product is novelty or originality. For a product that could not be constructed by or understood by, this is a quote, following some rule or other, just is the new thing par excellence. It cannot be accounted for as the result of what precedes it. Moreover, If originality is the sign or the merkmal of a genius product, then freedom is the essence of a genius's activity, producing a new thing without following a given determinate rule, an act that cannot itself be understood by following concepts, if there is such a thing, is an act that's independent of the determining causal series that precedes it. Kant often speaks of a genius power to create as a play, which sustains itself on its own. And at times he refers to it as the in-between, the Wortzwischen, an abrupt emergence of something new. If there is a beautiful art, then, it must be original and freely created. Anything less wouldn't be the creation of purposiveness without a purpose. Now, Kant calls the distinctive power, or the faculty, enabling genius to create, spirit, Geist. We met this concept a moment ago, that is in 1784's What is Enlightenment? Recall, Kant argued that enlightenment will have to be first achieved by the unique few who, and this was a quote, by their own exercise of Geist, escaped the yoke of immaturity. If and only if, he said, this unique few would then, quote again, disseminate the Geist of appreciating every man's vocation for thinking for himself, would enlightenment be achieved in the public realm. In the third critique, Kant then explains Geist in the following way. This is a quote. This ability of Geist to animate the mind is nothing but the ability to acquire aesthetic ideas. And by an aesthetic idea, I mean the presentation of the imagination which brings too much thinking, but which no determinate thought whatsoever, that is, no concept, can be adequate. If immaturity star, I remind you, if immaturity star was a danger that will make it our second nature to fall back on using reason mechanically, employing dead rational algorithms, statutes and formulas, then the faculty of Geist animates the mind, preventing the comforts afforded by using determinate, well-grasped concepts. It is exactly by creating presentations that cannot be grasped by any concept or language that the power of Geist animates the mind, and this was a quote, brings too much thinking, right? Enlightenment is thinking for yourself. The relevance, then, to Kant's word of enlightenment, hopefully, is beginning to be clear. Significantly, for Kant, comprehending something with a determinate concept just is knowledge. Hence, the distinction between knowledge and thought, or knowing and thinking, we have some Arendtians here, or knowing and thinking, introduced in the Critique of Pure Reason, is all important to understand what is enlightenment. It would seem that the enlightenment's knowledge-producing science cannot, strictly speaking, count as what Kant means by thinking for oneself. It is a work of genius, and the work of genius only, that's capable of preventing us from finding a resting place to reason. This is a quote borrowed from a different part of Kant's work. Gain knowledge, and precisely because we know, stop thinking. In fact, Socrates comes to mind here, and in the longer version of this paper, I have some reflections on Socrates, but we'll have to jump over. It is the operation of Geist through genius that has a power, quote, again from the third critique, to expand the concept itself in an infinite way, and only through Geist, I'm still quoting, that the imagination is fully creative and sets the power of intellectual ideas, that is reason, in motion. It makes reason think more when prompted by such presentation of originality, end quote. It is exactly by following the guidance of another, then, another that we cannot understand, that we come to properly think for ourselves. Of course, not every product that cannot be understood through available concepts can be described as a product of Geist. Not everything that cannot be understood is original or new. There is also what Kant calls, quote, original nonsense, originaler Unsinn, a product that cannot be conceptually understood simply because it is arbitrary or completely subjective. The production of such original nonsense, for Kant, is neither genuinely original nor free. It can at least in principle be explained by reference to an artist's personal states of mind, whimsical and contingent as they may well be. Indeed, it is tempting to think that anything properly new has to be meaningless in this way. For while if anything bears some relation to an existing conceptual scheme, it isn't genuinely new. Insofar as it doesn't bear such a relation, it is ipso facto meaningless. If this is true, then perhaps only anarchists can be revolutionary. The discovery which Kant came to make about genius, and which made him change his mind about enlightenment and about revolution, is that a product can be both original and meaningful if, but only if, it achieves exemplary validity. As original, it cannot be understood, grasped, or have meaning in relation to available concepts, but it can give meaning to subsequent ways of thinking. It can become itself a rule or a standard of judgment. If it achieves this status, it is meaningful originality, a work of genius rather than original nonsense. Quote from Kant, Third Critique, the products of genius must be models, that is, they must be exemplary. Hence, though they do not themselves arise from imitation, still they must serve others for this, that is, as a standard or a rule by which to judge. End quote. You see, I think, the relation here between thinking for oneself and following an example. So a deep sense of following becomes actually the way of thinking for oneself, if genius is possible. By creating something genuinely new in the world, genius gives the future a new meaning. Or in fact, more interestingly, strictly speaking, by creating something new, genius makes the future a future. For lack of meaningful originality, the future would be a mere consequence, quite literally indistinguishable from the present, which itself, for lack of meaningful originality, would be indistinguishable from the past. By the principle of the identity of indiscernibles, which states that anything that cannot be distinguished from another is identical to it, genius emerges here as a ground of time and of history. And this is, of course, connected to the concept of revolution. Interesting to think, by the way, then, of the connection between genius and its relation to time and transcendental idealism. So I'm digressing a little bit, but this is connected to the concept of revolution in Kant, I take it. Okay. This picture of thinking for oneself, that is, of enlightenment, depends on obedience in at least three ways, and I will briefly comment only on two because we don't have time. First, there is the obedience of genius to Geist. While genius is free in his production, he is free exactly through obeying something which is not himself. Geist is most certainly not his subjectivity or his own reason. It is through genius that Geist, and this is a quote, gives the rule to art. But this given rule is not understood even by the genius himself. So genius, as genius, cannot be said to be autonomous or even the agent of his act. He accepts a rule which is not his own making and which he doesn't understand, but he thereby comes to think for himself. I think this is fascinating. There is a fascinating relation here, a contradiction or a tension between the autonomy of the categorical imperative, which threatens to collapse into mechanical algorithms, as we saw, and radical thinking for oneself, which cannot be autonomous. So radical thinking for oneself cannot be autonomous. And this is important. Bear this in mind, because when we come to Kant specifically on the revolution and on the concept of the right of the revolution, this will be very relevant. Second, there is also the obedience of the spectators to genius, and through genius to Geist. the spectators overcome immaturity star, the tendency to think by statutes and formulas, only by following the guidance of another. But as I just said, even genius is not the agent of his act. Geist is. And even a genius doesn't understand his production. So this is doubly true about those who follow genius. They are observers, not actors. And since not even genius gives the rule to himself, but accepts it, the observers certainly are not autonomous either. How are we to call such a group of people? A cattle? They're following a given rule? In her lectures on the critique of judgment, Arendt constantly draws on the term spectators here to distinguish these people clearly from actors. I think this misses the point here. I will say a word about this later on. In a different, much-read paper, Glaude suggests to call this group audience, simply. The audience of originality is a term that's now frequently in use. And I think this does go in the right direction, but still everything gets lost in translation. The audience we're talking about here in German is das Publikum. The spectators of originality, those who follow the guidance of genius and thereby manage to overcome their immaturity, are, properly speaking, a public. They become a public, a bond of mature thinking people, by following originality. This notion of public takes us back to Kant's 1784 text. For, in order to understand more precisely his account of immaturity in this text, we need to reflect on the relation between two pairs of concepts. Private versus public, this is one pair, and obedience versus non-thinking, that's another. And I'm looking at Johanna because Foucault is obviously all important here. Private, in Kant's sense of the term, is almost exactly what we mean by public. It is a way of thinking and acting in our official capacity, fulfilling a role in some institution, or even most basically being a citizen in a country. Kant insists that in this capacity, what he calls private and we public, we have to obey. He even says, this may bear connection to this form of immaturity style, this private role requires a certain mechanical obedience to the law, so precisely following some statutes and algorithms. What Kant calls public, however, and we private, is an attitude through which one thinks as a cosmopolitan, if you'd like, a citizen of the world, not bound to this or that military rank, official institution, or country. Immaturity for Kant, then, is nothing but the tendency to conflate public with private. Immature is a stance in which I assume that because I obey the law, I cannot at the same time independently think for myself. Foucault is a philosopher who spelled this out most powerfully in his reading of Kant's essay. But here is a corollary that follows from the same logic and I think gets emphasized in the reading that I'm trying to stress here, but which Foucault overlooked. It's just a corollary of Foucault's position. Immaturity is a thought that if I disobey, I think for myself. The disobedience is sufficient for thinking. Of course, disobedience is not sufficient to thinking. It will produce, at most, what Kant called original unsinn, original nonsense, right? Such immaturity cannot produce a new order. It isn't the creation of a meaningful original, just of disorder. Okay, so it follows from what I've said so far that Kant's conception of enlightenment, understood through the doctrine of genius, is as revolutionary as an enlightenment concept can be. The basis of enlightenment is a genius creation of a new thing, a new order, the new demand thinking for oneself. But a revolution just is, and by the way, Kant is completely conscious of this. I could have shown this from his correspondence with Hamann, but I skip this here for time. A revolution just is a political counterpart of aesthetic novelty. A revolution is nothing but the creation of a new order, of new rules, of judgment in the political sphere rather than in the sphere of art. And this, like, it turns out that Kant would be even friendly to ideas about perpetual revolution, because, I say this here all too quickly, on his account, properly following the guidance of genius is exactly not following what genius did, but doing in turn something new as well. I was once trying to convince my senior colleague, Jay Bernstein, of this. And he said, what are you talking about? You're obviously right. Kant was a Maoist. he meant it. I think I can quote him. He's completely serious about this, Jay. Okay. So, here's potentially a challenge to the reading of Kant that I'm presenting here. And I'd like to elaborate this challenge a little bit in order to answer it, because I think it's the main, it will take us much deeper into this revolutionary conception of enlightenment. Was Kant not completely hostile to revolution? Right? That's the question. Is he not the philosopher of the moderate enlightenment, as Spinozist philosophers nowadays, whether French post-structuralist or Anglophone post-Jonathan Israel thinkers would have it? I think that there's much to say in response to this question, but the short answer is no. Kant is not hostile, neither is he a moderate Enlightenment thinker. In fact, Kant is so conflicted about the notion and the occurrence of the revolution that his view might seem contradictory, and hopefully here too, interpreting his Enlightenment essay in light of the genius doctrine, will allow us to treat his position as an antinomy, not as a contradiction. So let's begin. It cannot, and I would like to argue, need not be doubted that according to Kant, there is never a right for a revolution. That is, a revolution for Kant, strictly speaking, is always wrong. And the revolutionaries, assuming that they've failed and been caught, are always justly punished. Here's a quote. There is no right of sedition, much less a right of revolution. It is a people's duty to endure even the most intolerable abuse of supreme authority. Here's another quote from the famous, it may be true in theory but not in practice. I'm quoting, all resistance against the supreme legislative power, all defiance which breaks out into rebellion is the greatest and most punishable crime in the Commonwealth. And even if the power of the state or its agent, the head of state, has violated the original contract by authorizing the government to act tyrannically and as thereby, in the eyes of the subject, forfeited the right to legislate, the subject is still not entitled to offer counter-resistance. End quote. Doesn't get any clearer than that. This position is a direct consequence of, one, Kant's understanding of justice, by contrast, or duties of justice, by contrast to duties of virtue or morality, two, his contractualism, and three, the connection between contractualism and representation. Duties of justice are derived not from the categorical imperative itself, but from a principle, the principle of justice, which states that we should always act in a way that is compatible with the freedom of everyone else. These duties of justice are external duties in the sense that they are about what we need to do and about what others have a right to do to coerce us. Significantly, and bear this in mind, this is by contrast to the categorical imperative, which implies moral duties of virtue rather than ones of justice, and which are internal in the sense that they are about motives rather than actions, not about the doing, but about the motive, and in the sense that they are not about what others have the right to coerce us into doing, but what we demand from ourselves. Right? Now, because for Kant, only a government can represent a people's general will, a revolution being wrong, that is, contradicting freedom, is analytic to its concept. In other words, given that only a government for Kant can represent the general will, a revolution in the name of the people's will is a contradiction in terms. And more specifically still, since a revolution cannot represent the general will for Kant, it is always paternalistic. It necessarily involves some guardian or other imposing his or her principles on others. Hence, it cannot be the expression of autonomous public. It violates the very basis of the principle of justice. It follows from this that violent coercion against such a hindrance to autonomy is always just, necessarily, logically, because by removing a hindrance to freedom, you actually promote freedom, right? Whatever is consistent with freedom is just for Kant. So removing a revolution which is conceptually a hindrance to freedom, you're doing something that's just. So Kant's position is very strict about this. There's never a right to revolution, and there's always a right to coerce you violently if you revolt. And still, and this may be surprising, as such diverse authors as Arendt, Kosgaard, and Foucault have noticed, Kant looks at the French Revolution and at the public's response to it and sees it as a sign that the human race is progressing. And here is a famous quote. It became famous recently, I think. Kant writes, "The revolution of a gifted people, which we have seen unfolding in our day, finds in the hearts of all spectators a wishful participation which borders on enthusiasm, the very expression of which is fraught with danger. This sympathy, therefore, can have no other cause than a moral disposition in the human race." Okay, so here's the question and the contradiction. How is a dangerous wishful participation in a revolution, which we saw is unjust, a sign that the human race is of moral disposition and is progressing? How is an unjust revolution a sign of enlightenment? The Arendtian line, according to which we're speaking of spectators here, is helpful, but I think insufficient, if only because we're speaking in this passage of spectators who are, I remind you, wishful participants. So much so wishful participants that they are, in fact, in danger, as Kant says. That is, they're not quite spectators. They're not passive spectators. Kosgaard has suggested, correctly in my view, that for Kant, right and ought do not overlap. I actually did the setting up of this Kosgaardian solution a moment ago. Recall, as I pointed out, the categorical imperative and the principle of justice are not the same. Thus, there is at least a logical space, which is open, in which the moral thing to do, what I internally demand from myself, may be something that I have no right to be doing. In other words, even if there is never a right to revolt, it is possible that there is a moral duty to revolt. It is immature, by Foucault's understanding of the term, to conflate those internal and external duties. It is well possible that I ought to do something, even though it is something for which others may rightly punish me. So all this is the logical space of a revolution in Kant, I think, which does exist. But we need to notice that this goes even deeper. We need to notice that Kant's position on the revolution is a direct consequence of what I called above his mature account of enlightenment. We'll notice this if we listen again to a line from a passage from the passage I just read. He said, "The revolution of a gifted people, which we have seen unfolding in our time." Right? This is a mistranslation of the passage that everybody, including Kosgaard, has been used. Kant writes, "Die Revolution eines geistreichen Volks," the revolution of a spirited people, abounded with geist. That is, the sign that the human race is progressing has to do with the aesthetic response of the public to the geist that's expressed in the French Revolution. Recall, we saw that the Geist doctrine was in fact the key to Kant's 1784 Enlightenment essay. There, the idea was that mature thinking for oneself will be achieved if and only if the unique few will free themselves by, quote, their own Geist from the yoke of immaturity and proceed to disseminate the Geist of thinking for oneself to everyone else. This is what the revolution achieves. And if for a contractualist Kant, the problem with the revolution is that it can only be imposed, it cannot be an expression of autonomy, then as we've seen, the doctrine of Geist, in fact, has already overcome a simplistic interpretation of autonomy as the only basis for mature thinking for oneself. If in What is Enlightenment when Kant says, think for yourself but obey, meaning Friedrich, here Kant is basically saying, think for yourself but obey the revolution. The revolution is something that we cannot follow autonomously for Kant. We have achieved the reformulation of Kant's Enlightenment concept, which depends, really depends, logically, on his account of the revolution. First, sapere aude, dare to know, has to be omitted. Frankly, sapere aude, I think, is perhaps the greatest slip of the tongue in the history of philosophy. For Enlightenment, for Kant, is exactly not about knowledge. It is about thinking, and for Kant, those are not the same. Kant could have almost said, to paraphrase his famous sentence as a critic of pure reason, I had to deny knowledge in order to make room for thought. Second, also the statement about using one's own understanding without the guidance of another will have to be omitted. We can only think for ourselves by following another whom we do not understand. Kant's mature and revolutionary, I think, Enlightenment slogan would then read, dare to follow the guidance of another. Have the courage to think for yourself. Thank you.